This week, this month, we're going to be spending four Wednesdays on a series of lessons that have been entitled by your elders, Being in the World but Not of the World. That's probably a phrase that most, if not all of us, have heard our entire lives. If you go to church, probably anywhere, that's a phrase used commonly. Christians are in the world, obviously God's put us here, but we're not to be of the world, that is, following the patterns and lifestyles of those outside of Christ. We are going to be looking at that subject. But we're going to be looking at it with respect to stages of life. I was given four Wednesdays. The elders asked me to break up life into approximately four seasons, if you will. So we're going to start chronologically, and tonight we're going to take up those who are teenage, college age. I must admit, I'm not super fond of distinctions like that because there's a huge difference between 13 and 23. But you got to go somewhere. So we're going to kind of take that tonight. And if you're in that age group or close to it, please know, I'm talking to you. I'm going to be using the second person pronoun tonight. You. Not always, but often. I'm talking to you. But I'm talking to all of us also who are older, because as I think you'll see, I hope you'll see, there's a part for us to play in all this. So I'm going to start in maybe what seems like a strange place, but if you will, think with me about elephants. In the certain parts of Asia, farmers are still using elephants. They use them to uproot stumps, uproot trees. They're using them to haul logs around. They're using them to carry heavy loads. An elephant's a pretty helpful animal, tool to have if you don't have a bulldozer, etc. And in certain countries in Asia, because of the role that elephants play in the culture, they will have elephant festivals. And you hear that and you go, oh, that sounds really exciting. But it does sound like there'd be some interesting things there. They celebrate the strength, the agility, the intelligence of these. We were at the Kansas City Zoo recently, and we didn't go bother to see it, but we noticed that they have a time each day when you can go watch the elephants paint. Has anybody gone to see that? I've seen video of this. Elephants, you know, they're not going to do the kind of work that many of you in this room would. They'll probably do as good a work as I do, but they are able to kind of trace an actual silhouette that looks like an elephant or something else. They're very, very intelligent creatures. So during these elephant festivals, the elephant handlers will have them participate in games of basketball or soccer with these huge balls. And, you know, that would be entertaining. There's choreographed dances. But the main event at every one of these festivals is a tug of war. And the tug of war is between one elephant and 100 men. Now, granted, these are not NFL players. And it is true that many people in that part of the world tend not to be quite as large as some of the people in our part of the world. But a conservative estimate, that's 7 tons of humanity. Grown men who are used to working with their hands, all holding on to this rope, digging their heels in and pulling. And every year, every time, the elephant wins. Incredible strength these animals possess. Now, if you own an elephant, where are you going to keep him at night? You don't have some big, you know, reinforced steel apparatus cage like they might have at the Kansas City Zoo or elsewhere. What do you do? These people who own these elephants take the elephants home. They tie a little rope around their right rear leg. They tie it to a wooden stake in the ground and they go to bed. And they come out the next day and the elephant's still there. Now that elephant could very easily pull that stake up and walk away. It wouldn't even feel it probably. But that elephant stays there. Why? That elephant is not harnessed by the piece of rope. It is harnessed by shackles in its mind because it believes that that is strong enough to hold it down. I would like to suggest to you, if you are a teenager tonight, and I would like to suggest to all of us who are no longer teenagers that there are, I believe, that many, if not most, teenagers, young people in our modern American culture have been trained to be elephants. That is, they have tremendous capacity, tremendous potential, tremendous ability to assume responsibility and execute it well. But they have been held back from realizing that potential. They have been held back from even trying to realize that potential because they've got a little rope tied to them. And it's a lie. It's a myth. And what is that lie? Let's look at history just a little bit. At age 17, George Washington became the official surveyor of Culpeper County, Virginia. 17 years old. He goes off into the wilderness where the Native Americans are still well established, where people are living very rough and tumble lives. He's camping under the stars for 3 years. He's out in that world, away from home. His tools are heavy logs and chains. He conducts 190 surveys, and he comes back home with enough money to buy himself a 1,500-acre plot of land. Not bad for 19 or 20 years old. At age 10... Benjamin Franklin began working full-time in his father's candle and soap shop. At age 12, a little older than was usual for starting an apprenticeship, he was apprenticed to his brother James. 16 years old, he's still working for James because it was supposed to go on for 7 years. James gets thrown in jail. They're still under British rule. James said some things in his newspaper that people didn't like. Gets thrown in jail without trial. And for 3 weeks, 16-year-old Benjamin Franklin has to be make sure that the newspaper is brought together, edited, printed, and distributed. He manages. At age 17, Benjamin decides he's ready to make it on his own. He leaves Boston, heads to Philadelphia, lives there a year, gets himself established, comes back a year later to visit home with his pockets full of coins. Davy Crockett. He was never known as Davy. That was Disney that did that. David Crockett, 10 years old. He begins a career at sea, serving as a naval cadet. 11, he sees his first battle. 12 years old, he's given command of a ship that's been captured, a British ship. And he's put in charge of taking that British ship back to the United States. Now, because they had a code of honor at that time, the British captain was allowed to keep his pistols. The British captain didn't like being ordered around by a 12-year-old boy. So he says, I'm going beneath deck to get my pistols. And David Crockett, 12-year-old David Crockett, has a message sent to this British captain that says, if you bring your pistols above deck, you'll be shot and thrown overboard. Now, not that that's the way to do things. But it's a 12-year-old who's well in command of himself and the situation. Many, many examples like this. Clara Barton, founder of the Red Cross, at age 17, was already a successful school teacher with over 40 students. She'd already been in charge of taking care of people with smallpox in her community. Several, putting full care to taking care of them. Laura Ingalls Wilder got her first job teaching 2 months before her 16th birthday. My paternal grandmother was married at 18. My maternal grandmother was married at 22, but had already been teaching for 3 years. Am I saying you're supposed to get married at 18? What are you saying, John? Your daughter went and did that? No, but it can be done. It can be done, and it used to be done far more regularly than it is now. The point is, on that with respect to that, not that it ought to be, but it can be. What I'm about to say could be taken wrongly. Please, 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 parents, if you feel like I went a little astray, talk with your teens or your children later on tonight. But isn't it true that God does not tempt us beyond what we're able? Isn't it true that God does not put us in situations until we're ready to handle those? Isn't it true that teenagers are in a position to already bear offspring? What is God saying? He's saying they are able to rear offspring responsibly. Now you say, I'm not sure teenagers in 21st century America are, and you are probably right. But it's not because God made them that way. It's not this idea of kids having kids. That's a product of our culture. That's not a product of the way God made things. Look at the scriptures. David is a youth. Now, that's a word that's used very broadly in the Bible. It's used from a newborn child all the way to somebody about the age of 20. I don't know how old he was. 15, 16, 17, 18, 19? I don't know. But he sees Goliath out there. And he goes to Saul and he says, I will go and I will fight against him. And Saul lets him. You ever think about that? The fate of the Israelite army hangs on that battle. And Saul lets David go and fight. What's going on? Would we do that with somebody who was 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 years old? Underestimated by his king. To some degree, estimated by his enemy for sure, but he was a useful tool in the hand of God. Josiah becomes king at 8. At age 16, he begins to seek the Lord. At age 18, he is overseeing the refurbishing of the temple. And by age 20, he's leading the nation and getting rid of idols and idolatrous places of worship. Jeremiah is a youth. Same word is used for David. God comes to Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 1 verse 6. Or pardon me, Jeremiah says, I said, Lord God, behold, I cannot speak for I am a youth. God responded, Jeremiah chapter 1 verse 7. Do not say, I am a youth. You shall go to all whom I send you, and whatever I command you, you shall speak. Underestimated by himself, but he's able to be a useful tool in the hands of God. And Dane Hartman gave us an awesome lesson a week and a half ago, and he talked about Daniel. Daniel was a young man. Estimates have ranged from 12 to 18. Here he is brought into a foreign country, given a name, forced to learn all these things that he maybe had no interest in whatsoever. He possibly risks death by running against what his superiors say. He shrewdly works out a deal with management, and it all works out wonderfully. Was God involved? Absolutely. But how old was Daniel? Very likely a teen. 11 young people I just cited, people in their teens and tweens, and we could cite many, many more, who assumed adult roles and responsibilities. How often do we see this sort of thing today? Sometimes. And we probably see it more in the church than in the general population. And I think, you know, I was thinking about who I was talking to tonight. You know, I thought, you know, there's some crowds where some of what I'm going to say would apply more than in this crowd. I see a lot of excellent work being done here in the families. A lot of exemplary child rearing, and it shows in the young people. So I don't mean to say tonight that, you know, everybody's doing a rotten job and these kids aren't growing up. That's not my point at all. But if you are a teenager tonight, I want you to know that you are capable, as far as raw ability goes, God has made you capable of assuming adult responsibility. The word teenager, anybody know its origin? Came out of a Reader's Digest article in 1941. How come the word teenager didn't exist before 1941? Well, we've got all kinds of words now. We've got teenagers, and we've got tweens, and we've got 20-somethings, and we've got all these words we throw around. Why? Because as the years have gone by, and we can't talk about all the reasons for this, and I don't even claim to know all the reasons for it, but our society has grown increasingly obsessed with designating all these little brackets, all these little age groups, delineating and distinguishing people because of age, and retarding development. Prolonged adolescence was being observed all the way back in the 1960s, and it's getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And it hinders people from being what they can be for the Lord and in the church. And that's the reason I'm talking about it tonight. What do adults in a modern America expect of you, teenagers? What do you expect of yourselves? We tend to meet expectations. You ever heard of these two studies? One was done in a Bible college in Portland, Oregon. The other one was done in a middle school in San Francisco. Both studies were the same. There were two classes. And the two classes were statistically identical. You know, same dispersion of genders and, you know, whatever else. But the teachers of those classes were told the classes were different. They were told one class, this class over here is made of the best and brightest students in the school. And this class over here is made of the slow to average students. And then they watched to see what would happen. All the teachers' interactions with the students were tainted by expectations. When the teachers worked with the student in the bright class, they persisted with the student until he or she found the answer. But when a student in the slow class didn't find the answer right away, the teachers moved on to another student. When a student in the bright class struggled, the teachers just brushed it off, saying the student was just having an off day. But when students in the slow class struggled, it was just because they were slow. We rise to meet the expectations. They're self-fulfilling prophecies. Henry Ford said, whether you think you can or whether you think you can't, you're right. Now, there are limitations to that. I could never be an NFL receiver. There's nothing I could have done to get myself there, I don't think. It's just the genetics are not there. But for the most part, that is true. I'd like to read to you a brief excerpt from a book called Do Hard Things. Some of you have maybe heard of this book. It's not a perfect book. If you're a teenager, you know, maybe have your mom and dad check it out first or talk with them about it while you're reading it. But it's got enough good in it that I'll kind of semi-recommend it. The self-fulfilling power of expectations impacts teens in almost every area, often maddeningly so. Take, for example, tech savvy and sexual activity. And by the way, this was written by teenagers. I'm sure there were ghostwriters, but they were involved. These are two areas, tech savvy and sexual activity. These are two areas where teens are expected to have high interest and high performance. Just as you'd predict, the levels of activity, consumption, and even obsession in these areas are unprecedented. We are meeting the expectations set before us. Isn't it ironic that many teenagers, though fluent in multiple computer languages, that's quite an accomplishment, are not expected to understand or care about things like personal finances, politics, or our faith? We're not even expected to be capable of carrying on an intelligent conversation with an adult. Now, I don't think a lot of adults in this room feel that way. But he's speaking to the culture. Isn't something wrong when girls are constantly judged on their physical appearance and pressed to become more and more sexually provocative, yet are so rarely expected to develop qualities of character and intellect beneath the surface? When we understand the power of expectations, we begin to understand why things have changed so dramatically and why our culture has bought into the myth of adolescence without even realizing that it doesn't have to be true. So that's my brief summation of our culture's expectations. I would like to see this change. And I would imagine that there are many who are in the age group we're talking about tonight who are thinking, yeah, you know, I got to be careful how much detail I offer here, but one of my teenagers a few years ago was at a meeting, and it was And some of the teens were talking, and one said to the other, I feel like we're always being catered to and kind of babied. And it wasn't like a bitter complaint. It was just like, we can do something. We're capable of understanding. We're capable of, you know, we don't have to be treated like, you know, kiddies. And multiple ones have made that remark. Our former president, not our current, but our former, was quite an orator. And he had a great line. I didn't agree with most of his policies, but he had a great line in one of his speeches one night. He was talking to a big group of people, and he said, "We are the ones we have been waiting for." What a great line. What's that mean? There are changes we want to make. Who's going to make them? Here we are. We've been waiting for somebody. Here we are. I think we can change this, brethren. I think we're doing better than the world, but I think we can change this, and I think we ought to. And I think that probably most teens probably like the sound of it. You can tell me later. What does God expect? So we know what the world's expecting. What's God expect? If you are a teenager, one of the things that God calls you to do is to preserve yourself. When something goes corrupt, it's rotten. So God wants you to preserve yourself from going rotten. How do you do that? You practice righteousness. 2 Timothy chapter 2, I don't know if you want to turn there or not, but I'm going to turn there and just read a few verses. 2 Timothy chapter 2. Starting in verse 20. But in a great house, there are not only vessels of gold and silver, but also of wood and clay, some for honor and some for dishonor. All right, so we're talking about first century Roman world. A lot of this was true up until about 100 years ago in our own country, even less than that. You've got all kinds of pots and pans and things around the house, and some of them have very honorable things. You know, this holds valuables. But then you've got certain vessels in the house, the bedpan, that are for dishonorable things. Verse 21, therefore, if anyone cleanses himself from the latter, well, what's the latter? We'll go back to verse 20. There were two things, honor and dishonor. So if anyone cleanses himself from the latter, that is the dishonor, he will be a vessel for what? Honor. sanctified, that is, set apart and useful for the master, prepared for every good work. I wish this point had been driven home more to me when I was young. I'm not blaming anybody. I just wish it had. That I cannot be useful in God's kingdom until I take purity of life very, very seriously. We have a culture that says, hey, the young are going to sow their wild oats. I had a teacher in high school. Her name was Jeanette Williams. Maybe some of you knew her. Very good teacher in many ways. But she'd been a flower child. And she said to me one day, we had conversations that, I don't know, maybe you weren't supposed to have in class, but we had them all the time. About religion, very open, discussing Bible things and so forth. And the issue of sexual immorality came up, and she says, John, I just don't think we can expect that of teenagers to keep themselves pure. And she called herself a Christian. I just don't see how you can possibly require them. Well, God does require that. And God doesn't require things that we're not capable of doing. I heard this from Rick. I don't know where he heard it or read it, but what makes a young man laugh makes an old man cry. And the older I get, the more I believe that. What makes a young man laugh makes an old man cry. David said in Psalm 25, verse 7, "Do not remember the sins of my youth, nor my transgressions. According to your mercy, remember me for your goodness' sake, O Lord." David had things in his past when he was young that he deeply regretted. And he wished he could go back and wipe them away. God, don't hold them against me. It is easier to be foolish when we are young. We just don't have the experience to tell us that this is going to have a high price. I had a roommate in college who was a member of the church at the time. And he just seemed bent on doing stuff that was not very wise, it seemed to me. And one day he said to me, he's like, well, you got to learn from experience. And I was by no means Captain Wisdom, but I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. That's why there are wise people in the world to help us not have to learn that way. It didn't win anything, but it's true. Here's this book telling us that there are consequences. If you commit sexual immorality, you sin against your own body. What's that mean? Well, it has all kinds of implications, but you never live down the consequences of that sin completely. Solomon talks about this in Ecclesiastes chapter 11, not the sexual immorality, but the need for purity when we're young. Ecclesiastes chapter 11, I'm going to start in verse 9. Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verse 9. Some of you maybe could quote this for us. "Rejoice, O young man, in your youth." Ecclesiastes 11, verse 9. "Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these God will bring you into judgment. Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh. For childhood and youth are vanity. Remember now your Creator in the days of your youth." Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, he says at the beginning of verse 9. Now, there are some who think that Solomon's being sarcastic here, and that's possible. He's saying, oh yeah, go live it up, as you may feel inclined to do, but no, you're going to be brought into judgment. I'm not convinced that's what Solomon's doing. I think he may be mean this very literally. Enjoy your youth. Youth comes with a lot of blessings. You're stronger. You have more energy. Your mind is sharp. You know, the statistics show that you give somebody a list of 15 items, and I don't know, give them a minute or whatever, a minute or two to look at it, and from the age of, 20 to 39, they're going to remember 10 of the 15. From 40 to 59, they're going to remember 9 of the 15, and it just goes down and down and down. As the years go by, the recall lessons, et cetera, et cetera. These are not things we don't know. But when you're young, you've got, the best as far as raw talent you've got right now. You're optimistic. Rick and I used to talk about, because I used to be more optimistic than I am. Please don't let my flagging optimism hurt you, but I used to have these, ideas, utopia is possible. And, Rick would say, I'm glad for that, He knew the day would come when jadedness would start coming in, and it did start coming in. We need optimism. You know, those of us, and I know I'm not in the senior category, Lord willing, that day will come, but I've got enough years under my belt that I do see a side to things that I didn't used to, and it can get in the way of me jumping on something that could be good. So we need the young to say, hey, you know, this could happen. We can do this. All right, let's do it. You're ready to put the work in? All right, let's do it. Rejoice in that. But know, he says, that God will bring you into judgment. And that's what he's simply saying is, enjoy your youth, but remember that God remains just as much a part of your life as he does everyone else's. I think we tend to think, we don't literally think it, and yet it's almost like emotionally we do, that you look at the commands of God and there's this thing called a youth exemption. Okay, we can go sow our wild oats. You know, we can't expect young people to take living a life of purity as seriously as they ought. And, you know, when they get older, the expectations will change. I think we know better than that. But Solomon's reminding us of that. If you're young, remember, you're subject to the judgment of God just like the older are. You are free to choose how you will live, but you are not free to choose the consequences. You know, I can walk off the edge of a building. I am free to do that, but I am not free to decide what's going to happen when I do so. There are laws, and certain decisions have consequences. And if I choose to thumb my nose at God's will because I would just want to do my own thing, even when the world may be saying, look, we can't expect that of you. I mean, there's all kinds of science out there that you can't expect wisdom from young people, et cetera, et cetera. It's nonsense. It's nonsense. God gives these commands, and this verse is an example of it. God gives these commands to old and to young, and he expects us all to take those commands seriously. So he says in verse 10, remove sorrow from your heart. Anger, discontent, trouble, anxiety, different translations have a different word there. But the idea is, remove things from your heart that would bring sorrow. Live so that you don't have anything to be sorry for. Live with the future in mind. Put away evil from your flesh. Remember now your Creator. Now, don't remember it when you're 30. Remember now your Creator. Why is it important to remember your Creator? I like peanut butter sandwiches. And I used to use this example. I don't use it so much now because when you have children, just because you make it doesn't mean it's yours. But it used to be, when I made a sandwich, it was mine. I made it, it's mine. And I don't really make things. I'm not good with that sort of thing. But once in a while, maybe I'll make a song. That song's mine. It's mine. And I can copyright that. It belongs to me. And I get to decide how it gets used. Every one of us in this room, young ones included, you have a Creator. And the fact that He created you is indication that He owns you. And you owe Him something. He says this is the way to live. And your strength that He gave you and all that ability and that energy was not given to you so that you can use it for rebellion or so that you can use it to just pursue empty things. It was given to you for greater purpose. So God wants you to preserve yourself from sin. There's so much we could say about that, but we'll move on. And then He wants you to prepare yourself. We're going to talk about the specific things you can do, but this is the time in your life where you prepare as well. There are many things you can do in God's service now, but this period of your life is intended for preparing for the future as well. You want to be a productive servant in God's kingdom your entire life. So when youth runs out, and it will, it's going to run out. When youth runs out and all the things it allows you to do, what role will you fill then? Well, you know, maybe as you're a young man, you're thinking, oh, well, maybe I'll be a deacon or an elder, or I'll be serving as an evangelist or a pillar in my congregation. No, you won't unless you prepare yourself now. You, to be able to fulfill roles designated for the older, you must spend years beforehand making godly decisions. At some point, and it's different for everybody, but at some point, and it's like what John Greenleaf Whittier said, of all sad words of tongue or pen, the saddest are these, what? It might have been. And there is a point, and it's not some black and white thing, but it happens for everybody, where you cross the line and the opportunity to prepare for things is gone. It just can't be done. You can't go back and remake those decisions. It's like a mortar. You let the shell out and it's going. And it's going to go on its devastating way and it's going to bring about its consequences. So the message here is, do what you can do now in your youth so that you will be equipped to do what you can only do later. How do you prepare? What kinds of things am I talking about? Dane touched on a great one a week and a half ago. Here's a basic one. Choose your companions wisely. Evil companions corrupt good habits. Do we believe that? Dane said, look at the five people who are closest to you. Now, I had one of my kids ask me about that later. And, if you're still living at home, you don't have total control over the five people closest to you. So, we're looking a little bit in the future. But look at, which I don't know what my child was implying by that, but I did hear this many years ago on a motivational tape or something. It was, if you look at the five people, the five books you read, the books you read and the people you spend your time with will determine who you are 5 years from now. And there's a lot of truth in that. Who are the people closest to you right now? Dane, I wish I could just replay what Dane said. Because we can think to ourselves, oh, I won't be affected. Dane said in his own life, he thought that to himself when he was younger. I can be around these people and it's not going to affect me. And he found out he was wrong. Dane Hartman's a good man. Everything I've seen from Dane makes me very impressed with that man. I think he's a man of character, he's a man of resolve, and he's a man who found that he was affected by the people he spent time with. I've got to choose my companions carefully. What do your friends say about you? Who are your best friends? Spend time in this book. I like to memorize. But I have to admit, I hate this. But the stuff I memorize now does not stick with me the way the stuff I memorized when I was in... I would go back to my college dorm room sometimes. I didn't do this a huge lot, but sometimes. And I had some time in the afternoon, and I'd just open up a particular book, and I would start memorizing passages. Man, that stuff has stuck with me. It didn't take a long time, and it has stuck with me. Now I can spend time going over and over and over and over thing. It'll stick with me, but nothing like it used to. Make the most of this time. Well, John, I have to admit, I have a little trouble even being motivated to read my Bible because I'm not even sure I have any reason to read my Bible. I've cited this many times. I cited it a month or so ago in someone's class, or 2 or 3 months ago. Many of you have heard it. I'll cite it one more time. Tad Morris was the one who shared this statistic from this very room. When they asked college sophomores who'd grown up going to church but who had stopped going to church, why did you stop going to church? The number one reason was, does anybody remember? I know it's been mentioned by multiple people. What was the number one reason churched college sophomores had stopped going to church? They were never convicted in the first place. They grew up going to church. They heard all the same lessons. They, went home and maybe they said grace before the meal and all that. But they were never fully convicted in their mind that this really is true. Maybe you're in that boat right now. I just was contacted recently by someone who's not a teenager anymore. She's not been a teenager for probably 40 or 50 years. She's struggled with certain areas of her faith. Any thinking person is going to do that. I've been contacted by multiple young people. Hey, how do I know this book's from God? Good question. If you have that question, please ask it. Gerald is not going to think less of you. Randy is not going to think less of you. I'm not going to think less of you. Rick's not going to think less of you. Anybody in this room who you talk to is not going to think less of you. That question needs to be asked. Why am I saying all that? Deal with doubt. If you're not sure, now's the time to deal with it. Because you know what doubt tends to do when it's left alone and not dealt with? It gets bigger. It's like the old Cherokee story, the wolf that gets bigger is the one you feed. And you leave doubt alone and it will get bigger. So, tackle those questions. Discover and develop your talents. Everybody in this room's got talents and gifts. When you're young, maybe you don't even know what your talents are. I wish I had known some of the things about myself 25 years ago that I know now. Man, I wish I'd have known some of those things. And if I'd been more diligent about some things, maybe I would have learned them. Young man, on a public level, there are things you can be doing. Maybe, do you have a gift for reading? You know, some people are better at reading the Word of God out loud than others. And that's not to make anybody feel bad, but a reading can actually be a very meaningful thing. I think it's far underrated, but it has to be done well. And some people are more gifted in that area than others. Is that your talent? Do you have the gift of music? Well, yeah, I like to lead. Well, I don't really want to get up in front of the crowd. Okay, so be it. But maybe what you can do right now, anybody here like to write music? When I was a freshman in college, I was writing quite a bit of music. I mean, it was something that I could do, and it went into Lewis Garvey's songbook. That's just one thing. Teaching a little bit can be done. Praying, encouraging, listening, serving. Brian Miners has passed away now. I don't know how many of you that name even means anything. It definitely means something to some of you. Fred and Rita's son. We grew up together. And I was with Brian one Sunday afternoon, you know, just hanging out. I don't know how old we were. Maybe 14. I was 14, he was 15 or whatever. And we're on our bikes riding around his neighborhood, and Brian lived near Bill Ford. Brian had a real gift for people. I mean, he was really good with people. He was bringing people to church. Just, he had a real gift with that. And he goes, hey, let's stop and visit Bill. Now, I would not have initiated that. I would not have thought to do it. We stop in and we visited with Bill a little while in the afternoon. I suspect Bill remembers that to this day. That's something we can do at any age. You know, I realize it may not be exactly the same for you, but things like that. I'm going to brag on my wife. She's going to hate this. I didn't know she'd be sitting in the room. She's often with the baby, so I didn't know. But it occurred to me on the way here, so this was not too pre-planned. When Amber was in high school, she was talking with friends about the Word of God, and there was an interest in the Bible. And with Gerald's help, who was a teaching there at the time, there's Gerald, there was a Bible study started, and she was teaching that study. And, you know, I don't know what all of you believe about the role of women, but I think it's perfectly fine in that environment for a woman to be teaching the Word of God to lost souls. This is something she was doing when she was 17, 18, and there's nobody in this room who can't do the same thing. Maybe it can't be at the school anymore, but maybe it could be at your house. Maybe it could be at some, you know, some public facility, at the library or whatever. Ask for mentoring. I listened to a book. My time's almost up. I listened to a book 2 or 3 years ago. It was taking all this information from surveys done with millennials. And it was fascinating. Millennials deeply respect those who are of the older generation. Baby boomers didn't do that so much as a whole. But the millennials feel very differently. I shared this with a brother. It was Dennis Stanley. Dennis goes, oh, I can testify to that. He goes, we've got two guys who are millennials working at our engineering firm or whatever. And he goes, there are two of us, you know, in our 50s. And he goes, it's embarrassing how much these men, these young men, look to us, want to hear what we have to say. One of them's even got a little sign on his desk. What would Dennis do? You know, and Dennis is like, you know. Interesting. I wouldn't have guessed that. We need mentoring. You know, if you're a young person right now and you're like, I don't know what my gifts are or I don't know what I can do, find someone older in the congregation. It doesn't have to be real old. Find someone older. Hey, you know, you study the Bible with people or I don't even know. Well, could I come along with you? Could I shadow you? We do that in the work world all the time. Why not in the church? Oh, touch on point three real quick. Okay. You are going to have to prove yourself, though. This is very biblical. No man can serve as deacon who has not been tested and proven that he is suitable for that job. So you're thinking, all right, I believe you. I see all the evidence. I should be able to assume real responsibility. I can't serve as an elder or deacon, but I can do meaningful things in the kingdom, public and private. I want to do that. And so you go and you talk to your elders, or you go and you talk to mom and dad about it. And they're like, well, let's slow down here a minute. You think, oh, I'm being underestimated. Nobody's with me. Well, slow down. The leaders of this congregation and the older people in the congregation, everybody in this congregation will be more than happy to see you assume responsibility as you show yourself ready to assume it. ready to assume it. So I would recommend, go and talk to the elders. Say, if you don't already have an idea, say something like this. I want to be active more so than I am. What can I do? What can I do? And it doesn't matter how small that task is. Whatever it is. Winford Lee told a story one time. There was a brand new Christian to congregation. He was holding a week meeting, and this new Christian got there super early before the meeting, wanted to do something. Well, I think that maybe the songbooks and the Bibles needed to be straightened up. Well, Winford said, why don't you take care of that? Boy, got right after it. You know, whatever it is. Clean the building. What about when it comes time for a basket dinner? You know, I don't know how it works here all the time, but down at Murray Road, we use the basement for classes. And when we're going to have a basket dinner, tables and chairs have to be set up. If you're young, get down there. Beat Gary down there. Beat others in this congregation. Get down there and get after it. Get it done. It's good for a young man to bear the yoke in his youth, says Lamentations 3:27. I'm just going to have to stop. Let no one despise your youth, Paul told Timothy, but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity. Meditate on these things. Give yourself entirely to them that your progress may be evident to all. If you are a teenager, a college-age student, whatever, right now, who the culture is telling you, you're in your waiting years, you don't have a major role to play, I want you to know the Bible says you have a real role to play, and step up and assume it. And let those who are older kind of guide you through it. But show us your progress. Show the Lord your progress. Give the church that many more workers. I appreciate your attention. Thank you.